Okay, I am always real with you, but I'm going to tell you something really personal. Mental illness runs in my family, and no one ever called it a secret, but we never talked about it, not even with each other, until recently. Two of my uncles, who are now deceased, suffered from mental illness, and there is not a day that goes by that I don't think about how their lives might have been different if we had just had a better understanding of what they were going through. But I think a lot of the reasons why we're so bad at understanding is because society tells us that mental illness is a personal failing, a weakness. Here's the thing, though. As we learn more about how the mind works, we've got to try harder to understand the people we love who are suffering. I'm Tanya Mosley, and that's the topic we're taking on this episode of Truth Be Told.
Dear Truth Be Told.
Dear Truth Be Told.
Dear Truth Be Told.
Dear Truth Be Told.
I really need your help.
I need your help.
I need your help.
Back in the 2000s, Bassey Igbe was riding high.
Let's get right into it. Please give a warm Deaf Poetry welcome for Bassey Igbe from Nigeria.
Bassey was a popular spoken word poet, touring the country with HBO's Deaf Poetry Jam.
Welcome to the land of the soulless. Here, no souls rest. Black equals target for bullets, and we march to mourn another murdered in silence. Where do our screams go?
But those highs were more than the high that comes with success. These highs were manic. And the lows, they were the can't get out of bed, barely able to walk to the bathroom kind of lows. At 27 years old, Bassey finally had a name for this thing that had ruled her life for years, bipolar disorder. After her diagnosis with bipolar 2, she chronicled her journey in a best-selling book of essays called I'm Telling the Truth, But I'm Lying, and founded the Seaway Project, a nonprofit that promotes mental health awareness throughout the global Black community. Bassey Igbe is our wise one this week, and we started off our conversation talking about what those highs and lows feel like.
It feels amazing and exhilarating, and you feel powerful, and you feel like the most amazing person in the entire world, and that's a good feeling. You take on a lot. I know I was very active. I was going out a lot. I was, you know, meeting up with friends. I was writing a lot. I was performing. I was doing all these things. But once you stay up there, it gets frightening because there's no down, and it feels like there's no ground beneath your feet. It's disorienting. It is shocking because you're supposed to feel the ground. You know, you're supposed to feel even at some point, and to not feel that, it also triggers like paranoia, it triggers insomnia, it triggers all these other things that come with it. People don't realize how physically uncomfortable it is. There's a physical discomfort that comes with it that I was hoping that I could kind of describe in the book by laying out the picture and showing all the parts of it. Not just the parts that people see, but the parts that we feel and are unable to articulate.
One of the things that I've been sitting with, and I was really struck by something you said, it was in reference to Kanye West. And I think the question was, how can we differentiate his mental illness with his misogynistic behavior or with his outbursts against certain people or his support for President Donald Trump? And you said, we cannot.
It's easy for us to dismiss the impact that mental health has on people because, again, it feels, it looks, it appears to be a personality disorder. So if we're not able to link this medical condition with behavior, then it's easy to dismiss people. It's easy to turn our backs and turn our empathy off because the person is saying or doing something we don't like, because the person is doing or saying something that we don't agree with or is socially unacceptable. the reason why someone like a Kanye West is saying these things without a filter, because usually we have a filter, right? We think all kinds of things. I know that I, you know, will go to the grocery store and, you know, think, why is her hair like that? But I wouldn't say that, you're right, because I have a filter on. If my personality were different, I probably would say it. And I think that Kanye, he doesn't seem to be the most likable person. So the illness enhances that unlikability. Is that unlikability?
Yeah, I mean, it is. Like you gave the example of then based on your personality, how your highs might exhibit for you. So you might actually then be obsessing on whether or not you've offended someone or something like that.
Yeah, it just turns the switch up. You can't disconnect it. I don't think it's fair to, but I also think that people do it because it's easier. We've come a long way when it comes to mental health awareness, but there are still aspects of it that I think people are resistant to because it's confusing, because it's not easy, because there's no set pattern of behavior, so there's no set pattern of response.
Right.
I wish that people were more attached to the empathy part of it. And I don't think that we are yet. It's going to take a little bit more. Right now, we have all the language. We have all the words. We have ways to relate. You know, my nerves are anxiety. My sadness is depression. My hyperactivity or high energy mania. But it lessens it. It does make it much more difficult, I think, for people who experience these very large diagnoses. It reduces what we go through, I think.
I mean, how do we get there, though? Because there is not a person in this world who's not impacted by mental illness, either themselves, someone they love, someone they work with. I mean, your nonprofit specifically works with trying to really change this perception about mental illness and really bring about that empathy. But I'm thinking about specifically for the Black community. Actor Kendrick Sampson was saying one of the biggest barriers he sees is the myth that as Black Americans, we always have to be strong and that mental illness is perceived as a weakness.
Yeah. But I'm thinking about what's going on in the world now, and I'm thinking about how much Black people are forced to endure on what feels like a daily basis now. And not having permission to break is something that's going to break us. Long after people die from corona or police brutality or racism, people are going to keep dying because our emotions, our spirits, our will to live is being challenged. Because I see so many people just falling into a despair. What's the point? Right? What's the point of voting? What's the point of doing this or that? And that's part of what's hurting us. And I feel like we need to fake it until we make it, and not in the fake it, everything's great until we make it, but the pretend we get it, pretend that we have empathy, pretend that we're making space for people to feel so that when the time comes for us to support each other in a real way, we've already built the foundation for it.
This actually brings us to our listener question. It comes from Bree. She was diagnosed with bipolar disorder a little over a year ago, and she's been able to manage her disability on her own throughout college. But now she wants to be honest on job applications when they ask you, do you have a disability? Because bipolar does impact how she moves through the world. But she's not sure about sharing this. Let's listen.
Dear Truth Be Told, my name is Bree and I live in Detroit, Michigan. So looking for jobs has been like really hard just because it's still COVID and like I don't really have an essential degree, I guess. My degree is in English and creative writing. Whenever I get to the do you have a disability part and I see like all the bullet points, I'm just like, I mean, if you want to be technical, yes, but I always put no. As much as people like to say they're not going to discriminate against you, they definitely will if they feel like it. I just don't think people would take it seriously. I think people would look at me different and treat me oddly. And I noticed that whenever a job application is like, can you do this without reasonable accommodations? I'm just like, the accommodation someone would need who, you know, wasn't physically able and versus what I would need are completely different. So for me to just mark, no, I can't do this without reasonable accommodations, it's weird because my accommodations don't look the same. And I think that's very vague of them to ask people. My question is, how do I, as a graduate who is looking for jobs, navigate my disability in work?
Thank you, Bree, for this question, first of all. Bassey, your advice for Bree?
Yeah, based on the question, I do wonder if she's doing it completely on her own, meaning that she's figured out, you know, the crutches and the coping mechanisms and things like that, things that I did for quite a long time. The issue, and I'll get to her question, but the issue is that those crutches break, that coping mechanism falls apart because of how unpredictable this illness can be. You could be fine for 5, 6, 7 years, and then just one morning, you're not.
And Bassey, can you lay out for us some of the ways that you did that for yourself, what that looks like?
My experience is a little different because I don't work a 9-to-5. So pre-diagnosis, I was on tour with Deaf Poetry Jam. And what I'd figured out for myself was that when I was feeling that I was slipping into a depressive episode, I would just disappear. I would stay in the house. I would sleep or, you know, lounge around, whatever it is that I needed to do. I would just stay away. And then when my energy kicked back up, I would run around and do all of the things that I didn't do before, I couldn't do. And so I got this reputation with my friends, like, oh, she'll be back. She does this. She disappears and then she comes back. And
it
became, right, exactly. It became a personality trait. So did my coming back, high energy and let's go out. Let's do this. Let's, you know, let's have lunch. Let's, you know, all these things. That became part of my personality until I got the tour. And on the tour, I had to be in my dressing room at 7 p.m. I had to be on stage at 8 p.m. I had to give 3 hours of my life and a performance, non-negotiable. I couldn't disappear. I couldn't do all the things that I had constructed for myself to make this thing easier for me, whatever this thing was at the time. So listening to Bree, I'm thinking, let's say you do get the job. If you're not doing this with a therapist or a doctor, those ways you've learned to manage are going to fall apart because you have to be at work at 9. And as much as I would love a world where mental illness was treated the exact same way as a physical disability, it's not. And it's very easy for people to be dismissive of it. I personally, I never check I have a disability. I never check it because I know what the questions are. And I know that despite people's best intentions, there is a bias.
Yeah, we're not
there's
there
an unconscious
yet.
Bias, there's a conscious bias, exactly. And to navigate that before you even get the job is tough. It's tough. So I hate to say don't check it because I don't know what her needs are. Like she says that her needs are different. I wish in college I would have been more vocal about it because I think that it would have made my college experience easier. Mm-hmm. I probably would have graduated because I could say to my professor, I can't get out of bed today. Or, you know, I didn't have the confidence to do that then. I can definitely do that now. Now I'm nothing is more important than my mental health. So with Bree, I want to know why she feels like she should and also why she feels like she should without the aid of a medical professional.
Right. Those are questions definitely that she needs to be seeking a medical professional. But how do you manage finding a healthcare provider that you can truly trust?
A therapist friend says it's like finding a hairdresser or a barber.
Yeah, you just got to keep trying until you find the right one.
You need your hair cut. You need your hair done. And you can find the one that you go to permanently, but if you need it today, you need it today. So there are certain things that are, I would say, like emergency situations where you just need to talk to somebody, where, you know, you're either a danger to yourself or others and you know this and you want to have a conversation. You need to talk. You need to get something out. The therapist you see may not be the right one, but you're not married to them. In a perfect world, my answer would be one thing. But the world we live in now, I would advise not to check off the disability until you get the job. And then when you get the job, be clear with yourself what your needs are so that you can be clear with your employer. Because the question is kind of vague because there's so much we don't know about her situation and so much that we don't know about even the field that she's trying to get into. She said English and creative writing, right?
She has a vague.
Yeah, so are you trying to work in a newsroom? And you have to think about this too. There's certain careers that I personally would not.
Oh, this is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, yep. I personally would not even attempt because for me, it's too high pressure. Mm-hmm. The anxiety would be too much. The frustration could trigger depression. You know, there are all kinds of things. Like I couldn't run a Fortune 500 company because CEOs work long hours. I have friends who are in the medical profession who live with mental health issues, and they have to be very, very strict about everything in order to make sure that pressure doesn't affect them. Like it's very easy for me to say it affects nothing. You can do anything you want to. It changes nothing. But that's not the truth. The truth is it does. It does affect the way that we are able to function in certain situations, which is why you would need the aid and the help. So I think I'd just be very clear with myself, the jobs that I'm looking for, the opportunities that I'm looking for, and whether or not I can actually handle a job that says that you need to work 3 night shifts in a row, which messes up your sleep.
What I'm hearing from you are 2 things that you definitely want, if you haven't already, to find a medical professional to help you through this. But then also what I'm hearing from you is that it's encouraging to hear someone her age who is in tune with herself and her diagnosis. And being able to listen to the things that you need are so important as she navigates trying to find a job. Understanding what her pressure points are, understanding how she navigates. Those are the 2 most important things, I think, for Bree right now as she goes through what is such a difficult time for everyone to kind of live through at this moment. Which I want to know from you, I mean, how are you taking care of yourself?
I was working out for a while, and then my medical physical doctor said that I need to stop because I have other health issues that were being affected. Mm-hmm. I was playing tennis. I was, you know, doing all these things, and now they're like, you know, your heart's not great. Let's calm down on the cardio. So I have to readjust, which is what happens, right? This is what we do. I'm staring at yoga, trying to like it, you know, I do the work.
Both. But this has been a 20-year quest. I like get on it every few years and it's like, I got to make myself like this, but.
I don't like it. I try so hard, but it's just not for me. But I need to do something in that calming, that meditative approach to it. I am watching Hamilton a lot. I am giving myself permission to do the most unapologetically joyful, joy-filled things that I possibly can. More than anything, one of the things that's the most important to me is what I'm giving to the world. And if I can't give it to myself, there's nothing left for the world. So I'm being very careful and tender and gentle and graceful with myself. And that just means that means something different every day. That means something different every morning. This weekend, I built a dresser because I've had the box in my bedroom a month and a half. And I was just like, I'll just call TaskRabbit. I'll just find the time and get someone in here to do it. And I was like, I'll do it. And it's crooked.
Yeah.
You know, the bottom drawer, I have to lift the top drawer to get the bottom drawer to slide in, but I did it. You know what I mean? And I'm very happy about that. I bought sheets. You know, I'm doing these things that I have neglected to do because I didn't think they were big enough. Mm. And they're just enough. I'm stacking enough little joyful things to create something big. And like I said, it changes every single day.
It does. I have a friend who she's been putting off painting a room in her house And so she's like, you know what? I just said to myself the other day, I'll just paint a wall a day or a wall a week or a wall every 3 weeks. Yeah. And we have to kind of be kind to ourselves to do that. I mean, time is relative now. It doesn't even, you have to do what you feel in the moment. It changes day to day. Yeah. Is that kind of your advice for all of us? Because I'm kind of worried about everyone and everyone's mental health right now. It really is a lot.
Me too. Me too. I'm also very worried. One of the things that guides me is I celebrate the inches. I think that quite often we don't know how far we've come until we turn around and look. Mm. And I think that every step forward needs a celebration. Every step forward needs to be acknowledged. I celebrate every minute, every inch, everything that seems and feels like it makes me feel good. You know, like I think that we don't give ourselves permission, especially now, we don't give ourselves permission to feel good because the world is in chaos, right? Like people are dying literally and people are losing their jobs and people are not okay. So it feels almost offensive to find joy for yourself. And I think that that does a disservice to those people. I believe in collective kindness and I believe in collective joy. I believe that if someone is sharing good news with me, like I troll Twitter for good news. People are like, oh, you know, today's my birthday. I'm like, I don't know you would have a birthday.
Yeah.
You know, my birthday was a couple of weeks ago and I posted on Facebook. I was like, I want presents. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've gotten birthday gifts since I was a teenager. I want gifts. And I got sent gifts. It's the little things. And the little things aren't little right now.
Yeah. You've grown into that, though, I can imagine. Or have you always been someone to be able to tell others what you need?
I've grown into it. I spent a lot of time not wanting to be a burden because I felt like a burden to myself. I felt too big for my own head. So how large was I for the rest of the world? So I packaged myself small in order to avoid an explosion that took out too many people because I could feel that. My psychiatrist this morning said, you are hypercritical of yourself. And I think that I am also I'm hypervigilant because I am very aware of I'm very aware of the fact that people aren't islands, that we're all interconnected. And so I feel like it's my responsibility to make sure that my island is taken care of and make sure that no one else has to take care of my island. Hmm. And that doesn't mean that people don't care for me. It just means that because people care for me, I have a responsibility to myself. And I have a responsibility to those people not to give them too much to care about. You know, like, you're not here to clean up my messes. I'll clean up this little spill, but if I need help, I'll call you, you know.
Mm-hmm. Bessie,
and that took work. It took a long time.
It took a long time, but really what's so remarkable about you, and I want to thank you personally, is that by you laying yourself bare like this and sharing your story, it's a way for us to have a deeper understanding about the people we love in our lives.
You're gonna make me cry. I'm not gonna cry.
Well, I want to say that because I have people in my life with mental illness, and we watch the people we love suffer, but then I've seen tremendous growth and understanding in the last 10 years in ways that I feel hopeful for the future, but I also want to be a part of the solution in bringing empathy and understanding and learning myself. And you've been a big part of that learning. So thank you.
Thank you. And just from the other side, the fact that there are people who are willing to learn and willing to do the work it takes, and it takes a lot of work to understand and to allow us the humanity, because I think a lot of it becomes pathologized or becomes criminalized, especially for Black people. Mm-hmm. So to feel that we are not going to be, and this is why I'm so like, I take Kanye so personally, because it's so easy to feel like you're going to be thrown away. And so the difference it makes when you realize that people are going to love you anyway, it makes me want to work harder. And I think that if people realized that people are going to love you anyway, it gives me the desire to keep working at it. And I think that not giving up is the most difficult thing in the world. So having people who don't want you to give up, it's why I'm still here. So I want, no, I was avoiding this all day. Yes.
Yeah. Well, we've got to be better at loving and understanding and having empathy too. We just got to be better at it for the collective good of all of us.
For Bree, I understand that feeling useful and productive right now feels like what we need to be doing, but there's so much happening and there's so much we have to deal with that if it is possible for you to take a step back and not put so much pressure on yourself to get a job because you graduated or to get a job because someone is telling you to, then take that step back because there's nothing that's more important than you and there's nothing that's more important than your mental health. And if you feel like you've got that together and now you want to, you know, go out there and work, that's fantastic. But if you're doing it because you feel that you are only worth something if you're working, then I would ask for you to think a moment and consider whether or not you are capable of doing that right now for you. Mm-hmm. Are you doing this for you, or are you doing this because you feel like that's what you need to do? I think that especially Black women, we get so into this. Mm-hmm. Excellence. I tell people all the time, I am fine with Black mediocrity. Right. Black excellence is exhausting. Exactly. and it is a lot to live up to. So if you're Black average, fantastic. Let's do that too. Let's celebrate that too.
Yes, absolutely.
Take your time. If you just graduated college, you have time, sis. I promise you.
Yes.
You have time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Bessie.
Thank you. And thank you so much for all that you're doing to further the conversation. It is priceless. So thank you.
That was Bessie Igbe, author of the book I'm Telling the Truth, But I'm Lying, and founder of the nonprofit The Seaway Project, whose mission is to promote mental health awareness throughout the global Black community. On our next episode, journalist Farai Tadeh on why she thinks women of color are politics' sleeping giant.
Women of color are a very diverse group, which is why I say not just a demographic, but a super demographic, but we're pretty poorly marketed to and pretty poorly understood compared to our political power. Women of color are the secret sauce.
That's next time on Truth Be Told.
Hey there, I'm Susie Racho, the editor of Truth Be Told. First off, thanks for listening to TBT. We have a small favor to ask, though. KQED is hoping to learn more about how you listen to podcasts and what you love about them. So if you've got a few minutes, we'd love it if you could head over to kqed.org/podcast survey. Your answers will help everyone at KQED and Truth Be Told continue to make shows that you want to listen to. That's kqed.org/podcast survey. And thanks.
Truth Be Told is produced by Susie Racho, Issa Mendoza, and Katie McMurrin. KQED's leadership team includes Erica Aguilar, Ethan Tobin-Lindsay, and Holly Kernan. And as always, a big thanks to Kiana Mogadam. Truth Be Told is a production of KQED in San Francisco. I'm Tanya Mosley.